The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with, even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the sixth day of this seven-day Sesshin here at Mountain Gate in November 2009, and today is also Thanksgiving Day. And today I'd like to take up the story of a Soto Zen master named Tosui. This is from a book called Letting Go, the story of Zen master Tosui, translated in with an introduction by Peter Haskell. Tosui, as I said, was a Soto monk, although he trained with Rinzai masters as well. In fact, it almost sounds like he trained more with Rinzai masters than he did with Soto masters. He was born in the early 1600s, 17th century, as far as anybody knows. We only have a death date, and that's 1683. And his total name, Buddhist name, was Tosui Unkei. It was typical then and is still for a monk to have two names. The first is the formal name, which is the name he is given when he's ordained. And the second name is it's called informal name, which is the name by which he's known as a Zen master. In this case, Unkei was his formal name, and Tosui was his informal name, and so he is known these days as Master Tosui. He was kind of a radical character. There are several examples of radical monks. Radical in the sense of not being subject to the usual standards of life that Buddhist monks in Japan were. The poet monk Ryokan was one, wandering all over the country, writing poetry, teaching by his way of living. But eventually he ended up with a temple, and is at this point in time, that temple still exists in Japan, still operates in Japan, and a friend of mine, Edo Carney, who is the abbess of a temple in Olympia, Washington, is a Dharma heir of that temple. Another one is Tosui. And there were others as well who didn't go the usual prescribed route for a Buddhist Zen master. You have to understand that it wasn't just about expressing a totally free, in the best sense of the word, lifestyle. But it was also, in certain cases, and perhaps also in Tosui's, a statement about the current, at the time, condition of Buddhist monks and teachers in the eras in which these rabid radical monks lived in and wandered, because there were times in Japan, and Hakuin also railed against this, where the monks, the Zen teachers, priests, would be more attracted to name and fame than to actual practice or to manifesting that practice. And this is also produced a number of situations in which Buddhism was persecuted in Japan, and also during which the government kept a heavy hand on Buddhist concerns. Similar to that in China. In China, the government at various different times in the past, at various different times in the past, actually retained the right to approve or disprove people for ordination. And you couldn't become a monk or a nun without the government's approval. There was no way around that in China. In Japan, we have instances where the entire upper levels of the government was populated by Buddhist priests who essentially did nothing but run the country. And so some of these men were not just living on their own, but also making statements. And perhaps some of this is the case with Tosui. He left no words of his own written down. So what is known about him was gathered by people who knew him and trained with him or trained under him 50 years later by a Soto master named Minzen, who compiled a biography called The Tribute. Tribute to the Life of Master Tosui of Takagamine on the northern outskirts of the imperial city. And we will just share this. Master Menzan, put this together with illustrations, with woodblock print illustrations, which is considered possibly to be the first book of that sort which was illustrated ever published. And along with these autobiographical notes, Menzan himself also wrote some poems to sort of underscore each of these sections of notes. So he begins, "The master's formal name was Unkei, his common name Tosui. He was a native of the castle town of Yanagawa in Chikugo province, the child of a merchant family. His family belonged to the Pure Land sect. His father and mother were both devout believers, taking care to see that there were always incense and flowers on their Buddhist altar." And of course, they had a figure on the Buddhist altar. "The master's mother had a strange dream and became pregnant. From the time he was born, the child was fond of Buddhist images, having no interest in other toys. Once, seeing him leave the house with a statue of Amida, which is the focus of the Pure Land practice, chanting what's called the Nembutsu, Namo Amida Butsu, I place my faith in Amida Butsu, or Amida Buddha, with the intention of doing that enough that one will become reborn in what is known as the Pure Land, and hence the sect is called the Pure Land sect. Once seeing him leave the house with a statue of Amida from the household altar clutched in his arms, his mother ran after him. 'Here,' she said, holding out some coins. 'Take this money instead and give mother back the Buddha.' 'I don't want those,' the master replied, throwing the coins on the ground and running off, clasping the Buddha to his chest." Things like this happen all the time, so that the master's parents decided their child was not suited to becoming a merchant. Therefore, at age 7, he was given up to become a priest. He was packed off to Master Igan of Enoji in Hizen province, and Igan had the master's head shaved. Later, Igan left to become abbot of Ryucho-in in Higo province. The master was diligent in his studies and quick-witted. From the age of 13 or 14, his cleverness manifests itself. On one occasion, during the rainy season, a layman who was a patron of the temple noticed the master standing on a bridge holding a hollyhock. and asked him, "What flower is that?" The master replied, "Can't you see it's a hollyhock?" It was likely a trick question. What flower is that? Meaning, show me the essence of flower. And he responded, "Can't you see it's a hollyhock?" There was apparently an incident in Rochester when Master Sunsan Sanim came to visit Kepler Rishi. And Kepler Rishi was kind of fond of Dharma duels, he called them. They were later known as Dharma dialogues, but I think they were more like duels. They were an expression of an ancient custom in which masters would pit their understanding against each other. This was long ago in China, and this is how enlightened Zen monks would deepen and sharpen their awakening through these dharma combat, these dialogues. And so, and I gather that somebody, I don't know if it was Kapa Roshi or one of his monks, held up an orange and said, "What is this?" And Sun San leaned over to one of his attendants and said, "Has he never seen an orange before?" So it's a kind of a similar expression, most likely. And the poem that Min Zan has written about this segment of his biography is, "Though an infant, he transcends the causes of secular existence. Still unable to tell east from west, already he recognizes the truth. He clutches the Buddha, a treasure, in his sleeve, hurling away 1,000 coins into the dust beneath his feet. As mud sends forth the auspicious lotus, and the lotus grows more and more fragrant, as stone yields white jade, and the jade becomes ever more luminous. Henceforth, his reflected radiance will impart a perfume. He is about to awaken the people of the world lost in their dreams." The patron said, "If it's a hollyhock, how come the flower is red?" The name of hollyhock in Japanese is aoi, which is the Japanese word for blue. The master replied, "This bridge..." Which in Japanese, the word for bridge is hashi, which is also the word for chopsticks, by the way, but it's not the same kind of thing. It's not the same characters. The master replied, this is a bridge, but you're crossing it down the middle." The layman was left speechless. So, the poem written about that, a novice's sharp-witted reply. Plucking a flower, he ambles alone over the bridge. A layman, happening by, seeks to test his quick wits. Instead, the novice strikes back and reverses the situation. The arrow shot to the east turns and goes back to the west. Endowed by heaven, his wisdom encompasses the knowledge acquired from practice in previous lives. His accomplishment acknowledged, his wisdom gradually unfolds. With a single stroke, who can suggest the feeling of 1,000 miles? The marvelous feather of his arrow is about to leave far behind the dust of the world. And the prose continues. From age 15 or 16, without anyone's telling him to do so, the master undertook various practices, acting entirely on his own. He would fast for 3 days, remain standing all night in the garden reciting sutras and dharani, or stay alone in the deep mountains without returning to the temple for as many as 2 or 3 nights. At other times, he would practice zazen all day and night on the banks of a large stream. Such things happened on countless occasions, and what others saw and heard of Tosui led them to wonder at this novice who was so different from ordinary people. Egon, it is said, did not subject the master to any test of his attainment, simply calling him madman. which is a euphemism for someone who is deeply realized. Egon once instructed his assembled disciples, "The Buddha admonished his followers that monks must be dedicated above all to freeing themselves from the five desires. The five desires are the desires for sex, food, sleep, fame, and wealth. To free oneself from the last three of these desires is easy for one who's become a monk, but to free oneself from the two desires for fame and wealth is hard, even for a monk. If, as you attain seniority, people come to revere you, the desires for fame and wealth will grow more and more powerful. Then, after the fact, you will find excuses for glorying in fame and wealth. And that is why, I believe, the ancients warned us to guard against these desires above all. You who would call yourselves my disciples should know that your wisdom and realization are the result of what you achieve in your practice. Just take care at all times to free yourself of these two desires." Egon's instruction was detailed and thorough. When he'd finished, all of those present remained silent. Only the master, it is said, grumbled that he was being lectured about obvious matters as if they were things of real importance. After age 20, the master traveled on pilgrimage to the Kanto. That's an area of Japan near Tokyo. Staying for a time at Kichijoji in Edo, which is Tokyo. While the master was in Edo, he stayed at a temple in Shitaya that had used several hundred wooden memorial tablets to fence off its grounds. Now, these memorial tablets are tall, slim pieces of wood, thin, tall, slim pieces of wood. And they're usually leaned against or stood up in front of the gravesite of someone who's died. And on those tablets, called ihai, is written the posthumous name of the person and sometimes some sutras or something else. And they're there as memorial tablets, really. But it seems that in that particular era, or up into that particular era, with wood so short, after a few days or weeks, these ihai would be taken away from the graves and used as fence stakes, pickets. So while the master was in Edo, he stayed at a temple in Shitaya that had used several hundred wooden memorial tablets to fence off its grounds. Worse yet, the master often noticed that the fertilizer the temple's servants threw on the vegetable garden, and in those days it was human shit, would splatter the tablets. This troubled him, and every day he would go out in the streets to beg, using whatever money he received to purchase planks of wood, which he brought to the temple, replacing the tablets with a new fence he made from the planks. The master then carried the memorial tablets to the Sumida River and set them adrift as he chanted sutras. When the temple's abbot was inspecting the vegetable garden, he noticed the new fence, accusingly questioning one of the monks from the kitchen about this. Gather that the abbot assumed that the monk had used the money for the kitchen for building a new fence. He was told that monk who recently came to stay at the temple used his own money, purchased planks, and set them up, taking the memorial tablets from the old fence and tossing them into the river. They weren't exactly tossed into the river. That was one of the two things that normally was done with those memorial tablets. They were burnt, or they were set afloat in a river to appease the spirits of the dead. In Japanese culture, It's interesting that excrement is both a subject of amusement and denigration. And so for these memorial tablets, which were honoring the dead, to be set up in a garden where they were splattered with poop was quite demeaning to those who had died. It was a common practice, apparently, however, because of this question of wood being so expensive, even then in Japan. The abbot was mortified. Word that the tablets from the old fence had, one and all, been thrown into the river and a tall new fence put up in their place was bruited about everywhere. As a result, it is said that at that time, the use of memorial tablets for fences in the Soto school temples in Asakusa and in Shitaya ceased. And the poem regarding the pilgrimage, which is what he was already on, traveling on pilgrimage with staff and bamboo hat. In the east, he begs for the Dharma. In the south, he travels to consult with teachers. The free life of a pilgrimage monk. Following in the fragrant footsteps of the masters of old, he carries his bag on his back. To the pavilions of wisdom beyond the steep mountains, he journeys thousands of steps. And with one snap of his finger, penetrates Maitreya's innermost gate. Looking up from under his bamboo hat, he sees Mount Fuji's peak, sheer, soaring, covered in snow. His straw sandals are soaked from Lake Biwa's boundless waves. The Soto and Rinzai temples of Japan are filled with lazy fellows. One must realize thoroughly what it means to carry the Zen monk's wisteria staff. The master continued his pilgrimage through the provinces, studying with all the famous teachers of the day. He participated in the assemblies of Daigu, Gudo, Ungo, Shosan. The first three of those are Rinzai, masters in the Myoshinji lineage, and others, and visited Takuan in Edo. He met Ingen in Nagasaki and later spent 7 or 8 years in residence at Mount Obaku, during which time he established close ties with Mokuan and Kosen. Ingen, I believe, was a Chinese teacher. Yes. Known in Japanese as Ingen Ryuki. And he was the founder of the Japanese Obaku School, which doesn't exist anymore. It is the few, there are only three originally Obaku temples left in Japan now, and they've been subsumed into the Rinzai sect. So the point here, though, is that, and this was typical of his era, Hakuin did the same thing roughly a century later, and that was to travel around and experience the teachings of the famous masters. In Hakuin's case, he found no one that seemed to have a deep awakening and a profound understanding of the Dharma. But he eventually developed it himself and taught his monks, and now all of the Rinzai sect temples in Japan trace their lineage through Hakuin. Learning that Igan was serving as abbot of Yuchoin, the master returned to see him and served as his attendant for more than 10 years. So he did settle down and worked very closely with the master. If you're the master's attendant, that's some pretty serious training. You're basically available 24/7. Have no time for yourself, and simply in observing the master's behavior, activities, demeanor, one can gain teaching But besides that, he probably was given some instruction, just offhand, informal instruction that the resident monks may not have experienced. Besides that, just the sheer amount of service one offers to the master hones the monk and sort of, it's almost like a sandpaper, it works to shave away the monk's delusion, false self-image, and other things like that. And often it is the attendance, particularly the long-time attendance to Zen master, who become deeply awakened themselves. I have a little bit of experience in that direction, having spent time, several years altogether under Kapler Roshi as one of his attendants, including a total of about 9 or 10 months in Mexico on two different occasions. And in fact, the Mexican Sangha called the two of us who were his attendants Los Esclavos, translated to the slaves. But, you know, you learn some incredibly important lessons and drop some serious baggage in living in that way. So, Tosri has spent 10 years, more than 10 years, with Master Egon. The master was appointed head monk of Master Being, Tosri, was appointed head monk of Dainiji in Choshu, and on the 11th day of the 7th month of the 3rd year of Meireki, which was 1657, the Japanese calendar, traditional calendar, is measured by the years of reign of a particular emperor. He entered Egon's chambers and completed his studies by becoming his teacher's Dharma heir. The following year, he underwent the Avasi ceremony at Sojiji, which is one of the two headquarter temples of the Soto sect in Noto, and then assumed Avasi of Josuiji in Nango in Higo. And here's the verse about sending the memorial tablets down the river. One should recognize what is lofty and exalted, the dignity of a stupa. These were called, the translated word was stupa for these planks. Revealing the Tathagata's five wisdoms, even erecting a single wooden stupa brings posthumous benefits to the deceased. Instantly demolishing the great prison of hell and sparing one from the sea of transmigration. Those who are blind to the working of cause and effect will bind together wooden stupas to make a fence. Those who can distinguish truth from falsehood will untie the stupas and hurl them into the stream. When the stream's waters enter the ocean, the limitless virtue of this deed will surely delight the dragon king and save the creatures of the deep. On one occasion, the Kumamoto monks, Korin and Dayu, together made a long journey of more than 10 ri, which is something like 24 miles, 26 miles, to see how the master was faring. When they arrived at sundown, the master was delighted and told them, "Having come such a distance, you must be famished. I'd better straight away prepare your evening meal. Why don't you just rest?" When the master went into his room, the monks heard the sound of something or other being pounded in a mortar. Time passed, and it was already the 4th hour of the night. It was quite late. But though they waited, the master did not emerge from his room. Curious about what he was making, Dayu peeked through the sliding door and saw the master putting something into an earthenware mortar and pounding it with a wooden pestle. Mystified, Dai Yu asked from behind the door, "What is your reverence making?" The master, still pounding away intently at the barley, replied, "I ran out of the rice I got as alms. Since the village is a long way off and it's nighttime, there was nothing to be done, so I'm taking the barley I received from my begging and grinding it up to make barley rice in order to offer you something to eat. I wanted to do it quickly, but it seems I'm getting nowhere." Exchanging sympathetic smiles, the monks, disarmed by the master's innocence, whispered to one another, "If he's still grinding that barley now, how will he ever have it ready for dinner?" They then made the master stop, and resigning themselves to their hunger, spent the whole night listening to his Dharma talk. Ko Rin and Dai Yu stayed the following day and used their own money to buy a small amount of food which they offered to the master before returning to their home temples. It is said that afterward, the two monks recounted this as a once-in-a-lifetime experience. And these two monks that came to visit him were both abbots of their own temples. And the poem regarding that: a worn-out robe and 5 copper coins, a distinctly individual hospitality. It's hard to hastily explain to others the master's everyday mind. His body at ease, like the drifting scraps of cloud reflected in the valley stream. His mind bright, like the moon's radiance illumining the mountains. Horse barley is sufficient to sustain his life, a result of his karmic conditions. Like a honeybee among flowers, he diligently busies himself entertaining his guests. He just clutches the bowl that has been passed down in unsullied purity through the generations, and having no bottom, it swallows up all within the 10 directions. That's his awakened mind, that bottomless bowl. When Master Sengan was third generation abbot of Yuchoin, the Zen master Tetsugen delivered lectures on the Lotus Sutra. The master was among those present. He would sit by himself just outside the reception hall behind a clothes stand on which he had draped the worn-out altar cloth he used as a robe. That sounds quaint, but it apparently was something of a practice in those days to reuse and scrap materials which had originally been altar cloths to make the Buddhist robe. And it was very likely what's called the kesa, which is the ceremonial robe. It's not the regular day-to-day robe. One day, the sky suddenly turned overcast, and the master, barefoot and wearing his dilapidated robe, rushed off carrying buckets of manure, which he proceeded to spread on the vegetable garden. It's an interesting thing for a guest to do. Seeing this, Sengan rebuked him angrily. "Imagine doing such a filthy work," he scolded. "As a Buddhist monk, how can you touch excrement? Stop that immediately." The master replied calmly, "If that's the case, then one can't even wipe one's ass in the toilet." That was before the era of toilet paper. "Everyone uses the same hands they wipe their ass with to pray. But I never heard of the Buddhas or Bodhisattvas taking offense. And manuring the vegetable garden probably isn't even as filthy as that. I only did it because I thought the eggplants were looking skinny." And no doubt he went out and did it just before a rainstorm so that it would soak in nicely. He said nothing more. This was heard by all the men and women assembled to listen to the lecture on the Lotus Sutra. Some laughed, it is said, but others were moved. Hakuin had a remarkable young student, a girl, who one day her father found her sitting zazen on a chest that held a Buddha inside it, where Buddha figure was stored. And he said, "Don't sit on top of the Buddha." And she replied, "Show me where there isn't Buddha, and I'll sit there." It's interesting that Hakuin wrote more than once that she got the best of even him with her deep understanding. The Osaka Hōganji had been repeatedly robbed, and no one could be found to serve as abbot. That's the temple Hōganji. As the position had remained vacant, one of the temple patrons who knew the master offered him the post, and accepting the invitation, the master assumed the temple's abbacy. Never liking to be tied down, the master made a singular abbot. It frequently happened that he was away from the temple for as much as 10 days at a time, locking the door behind him and leaving only a servant as caretaker. This irked the temple patrons, but concerned that if they offended the master, he would leave for good and go someplace else, they went out of their way to please him and urged him to remain as permanent abbot. The master had served only 2 years as abbot when the following incident occurred. A certain Hirano, a samurai from Kumamoto in Higo, had been the recipient of a large stipend, but for various reasons become a masterless samurai and moved with his entire household to Osaka. With no residence for his retirement immediately available, he went to Hōganji to visit the master, whom he knew. The master was delighted and told him, "It's good to see you. Stay as long as you like." The upshot was that some 20 people, including male and female followers, and this part was a no-no also, were accommodated. Every day they would noisily bustle off to go sightseeing and visit temples and shrines all over the city. This came to the attention of the town constable, who reported to the authorities that some apparently high-ranking samurai, along with a large party of male and female followers, were staying in Hōganji, and that every day they went off on excursions. "This requires looking into," the authorities declared. The result was that the abbots of all the Osaka Soto school temples were, without exception, summoned to appear the following day at the magistrate's headquarters. That evening, a meeting was held at the temple of the Furigashira. The Furigashira is the sort of the liaison between the government and the temples. Everyone said, "This time, the abbot of Hōganji's free-willing behavior has finally gone too far. It's always been a strict rule in the city of Osaka that when persons armed with lances or halberds are staying in the town, the local officials must be notified in advance and must inform the city magistrate. In the case of temples, the Furigashira must always be notified and then inform the city magistrate. However, without any such notification, these visitors stayed at the temple for several days, with the result that when this came to the authorities' attention, it incurred their censure. To have all the abbots of the Soto school in Osaka summoned by the authorities like this, there's never been such a scandal. As to tomorrow's investigation by the magistrate, since we failed to notify the authorities of this matter, they have called a general meeting. So there's no way we can avoid dealing with this now. However, let us do our best under the circumstances. How many days together have these guests been staying at the temple?" The master replied, "These samurai are people from Kumamoto. There's nothing in the least disreputable about them. That's precisely why I let them stay. They arrived sometime after the middle of last month, so I think they've probably been with me 32 or 33 days. Hearing this, the abbots all declared, "No wonder the constable found out. If you give that sort of explanation, it's going to be serious. So you'd better let us do all the talking. You just bow low and keep absolutely quiet the whole time." The master agreed to do as he was told, and everyone left. Sure enough, the following day, when they assembled, abbots presenting themselves at the magistrate's headquarters, the magistrate himself questioned them directly. "It has come to my attention," he said, "that samurai armed with lances and halberds have been staying secretly at Hōganji, together with their followers, some 20 persons in all. This has been brought to my notice by the constable. I understand that these persons have been at the temple for a considerable time." "Abbot of Hōganji," the magistrate thundered, "tell me plainly and truthfully, how long have they been there?" Tōsui remained silent, without answering. While the Furigashira said, "It has not been so long a time as your lordship heard. I've ascertained it to be merely the last day or two. Indeed, all the abbots have ascertained this to be the case. Whereupon every one of the assembled abbots promptly swore that, as had been stated, it was a matter of no more than 1 or 2 days. So there had not been time to inform the Furigashira. Hearing this, the magistrate once again questioned the abbots. "Let me caution you," he said. "Persons reported seeing the visitors at Hōganji during the last part of the previous month. So the 2 or 3 days is surely closer to the truth." I think that's not an accurate sentence, but anyway. "Slight though the difference may be, this is an official matter, and if anyone is lying, there will be no lenience shown, even for priests. Isn't there a small discrepancy in your account?" The Furigashira declared, "With all due respect, there is no discrepancy whatsoever in what I have stated." Tosui then raised his head and said, "What the Furigashira has just told you is what we decided at our secret conference last night. But to be perfectly truthful, my guests arrived in the middle of last month and only left yesterday, so that altogether they stayed 34 or 35 days. When he heard this, the magistrate appeared amused and declared, very well, it's over with, so we'll leave it at that. But don't let it happen again. Now, all of you, go." The abbots then departed, let off without any further charges, and the case was closed. On the way home, all the abbots, laughing sardonically, berated the master. "Really, Hōganji?" A master of a temple was called by the name of the temple, so he would have been called Hōganji-san. "How could you have said such a thing to the authorities? You're absolutely pathetic." Only the master seemed pleased, as if congratulating himself. The magistrate threatened that if we didn't tell the truth, he'd show no leniency, even if we were monks, he said. And look, by telling the truth, everything turned out all right. And the poem about that one, meeting with a reprimand at government headquarters. At Osaka, the master absents himself from his temple, shutting the brushwood gate. By chance, he meets up with an acquaintance from home and welcomes a layman at the monk's dwelling. Compassion commands sympathy for a friend's situation. At the official quarters, a harsh rebuke excoriates the master's error. For a time, storm clouds gather and thunder peals, but in an instant later, the rain is gone and the sun is shining brightly. He's never been bothered by idle concerns. What a pity that in our world the awakened are so rare. On the way home, all the abbots laughing, we already read that. During this period, a monk named Eijo, a disciple of Zen Master Unpo, learned that the master was abbot of Hōganji and visited him there, paying his respects. He remained at the temple for half a year, serving as the master's attendant. When Eijo begged the master for agata to express his teaching, the master offered the following verse. "Eijo, let your wisdom and meditation be clearly illuminating, and then and there you'll let things go. Let go. Let go even of letting go. Then what will be left to let go of? Drink your tea, eat your rice. Don't go looking anywhere else. Eijo, let your wisdom and meditation be clearly illuminating, and the 10,000 things will all come to rest." Let your wisdom and meditation be clearly illuminating. Don't do Zazen with some idea of what it means to do Zazen. Don't carry around a picture in your mind of what real Zazen is. That's a huge mistake. Give yourself to that Zen. Search deeply. Search deeply with the koan, following the yearning down, and then following it down further, and following it down further, seemingly, endlessly, suddenly, you'll know. And along the way, you'll see a lot of things about yourself, about life, you'll see where you're caught. You'll see how to become free. It will be easy then to let go. Just don't try to reach some particular mind state in your practice. Give yourself up in each breath. Let go. Let go. Let go. And this is how you can reach the same mind state that Tosui did. And to become as free as he. You may not do the kinds of things he does, but you will be free to do what you know deeply is appropriate in each moment, and it will be effortless. That place of letting go is very, very important. Letting go ideas about ourselves. Letting go habit patterns of greed, anger, and delusion. Because only then can we truly become free. If we have anything left buried inside, hidden from our own view, it's going to lead us around by the nose. And we'll be stuck. Let go. Trace the radiance down. Don't stop. Don't try to shove anything aside. Open your arms and welcome it all in. But focus on that search, on that yearning to know. That's how you will come to know the truth and to be freed from it. Ajo, let your wisdom and meditation be clearly illuminating, and then and there you'll let things go. When we let ourselves see clearly, we don't try to frame our mind state, restrict our mind state, but open, as I said, to welcome all sensations, thoughts in without creating them. But if they happen to come up spontaneously, not to shove them aside. Let go even of letting go. Then what will be left to let go of? Drink your tea, eat your rice. Don't go looking anywhere else. Ajo, let your wisdom and meditation be clearly illuminating, and the 10,000 things will all come to a rest. During the Master's abbacy at Hoganji, he would go out begging every day, accompanied by no more than one or two attendant monks. He would take whatever raw rice he received, cook it, and use it to make as many rice balls as he could. Then promptly at dusk, he would bring the rice balls to the place where the beggars gathered and personally distribute them to each of the beggars. With whatever cash he received from begging, he would buy rice cakes and give them to the beggars' children. He would do this as often as 10 times in a single month. The merchants were moved on learning of this, and in increasing numbers they would wait for the master and add copiously to his bowl. When the master returned to his native Yanagawa, the monks and lay people of the area thought it was a precious opportunity and treated him to remain for a while and deliver sermons. In response, the master lectured on the final teaching sutra. That's the last teaching the Buddha gave as he lay dying, as a transfer of merit to his deceased parents. A large audience assembled to listen. Offerings were plentiful, and all were donated to the temple holding the lectures on the sutra. This came to the notice of the local officials, and they begged the masters to settle permanently in the province. but saying that he had never had any intention of settling in his native district, he went to stay at Seiunji in Shimabara in Hizen. At that time, the lord of Shimabara, the daimyo Koriki Sakon, invited the master to assume the abbacy of Zenrinji in Ninji. The previous abbot had a passion for flowering shrubs. He had planted peonies and terraces all over the garden, and when they were in bloom, he would hold banquets and invite guests. The first thing the master did on becoming abbot was to dig up the garden, wielding the mattock with his own hands. Bringing tea plants from Takizaki in Hizen, he planted them instead. Among those who saw or heard this, some praised the master and others condemned him. But the great patron Lord Koriki declared, "He is a true monk." It sounds like what the former incumbent of the temple was doing was beautifying the temple in order to show it off. And there was some smell of name and fame in there. And when Tosui went to take over the temple, he dug up all those flowering shrubs and instead planted tea, which would be useful and helpful. In a kind of a statement about not getting too tied up in possessions, whether it's possessions of a self-identity, which is the most sticky possession of all, or material possessions. And I think we'll stop here now and perhaps continue tomorrow.